Have you ever really truly stopped to think about what the world to come, Olam Haba, actually means?
It's a phrase we hear a lot, right?
Exactly. We have a general idea, maybe. But according to the source we're diving into today, the great Maimonides, the Rambam, well, he looked at this concept and saw something incredibly deep.
Something complex that he felt many people were just completely missing. And it's fascinating because the article we're looking at points out Maimonides saw this as a wonderful point, his words, that was just widely overlooked.
Not just by ordinary people either.
No, not at all. Even among, learned individuals, people within religious circles, his observation was that they weren't really asking the fundamental questions about it.
Right. It sounds like people just assumed they knew what Olam Haba was and then immediately got sort of bogged down in the surface details. So our mission today is really to unpack Maimonides' perspective on Olam Haba, using this source article as our guide. We want to understand how he challenged those common assumptions.
And how he linked it all back to the bigger picture, right? The fundamental purpose of serving the creator.
Exactly.
And the source does highlight his motivation. Maimonides felt a need to clarify this because, well, foreign beliefs and misunderstandings had kind of crept in over time. He wanted to ensure the authentic tradition stayed clear. And this concept, Olam Haba, specifically needed careful explanation in his view.
So even something seemingly foundational, like our ultimate spiritual destination, Maimonides saw a real gap in understanding. Which brings us to, well, the first puzzle piece from the source, the questions people weren't asking.
Exactly. He noticed the striking lack of inquiry into the real core, the essence of Olam Haba.
Like, what is it fundamentally?
Is it the ultimate goal itself? Or maybe a state that results from something else? How does it relate to or differ from, the actions and stages that lead us towards spiritual perfection?
These big foundational questions.
Right. And in his view, they were just largely ignored.
But people were asking questions about the future, just different kinds, weren't they? The source mentions what people typically focused on.
Oh, absolutely. They had plenty of questions, but they were focused on the very specific, often physical details of future events.
Like what?
Well, think about it. How will the dead be resurrected? Okay, fair question, maybe, but then will they be naked or clothed?
Right.
And if they are clothed, will it be in the same clothes they were buried in?
Wow, really specific.
Very specific. Or questions about the messianic era, like when the Messiah comes, will the rich and poor suddenly be equalized? Will there still be, strong people and weak people?
These are very concrete, almost tangible concerns.
They are. And the article suggests Maimonides saw these questions as, well, revealing a pretty superficial grasp of the whole concept.
Because they were fixated on the physical stuff.
Exactly, the physical manifestations. They assumed those things were the definition of Olam Haba instead of questioning its deeper purpose, its true nature.
Okay, so Maimonides sees this problem. People are stuck on physical details, missing the spiritual core. How did he try to, guide people towards a deeper understanding?
This is where his method gets really, really interesting. The source describes this brilliant parable he uses.
A parable, classic Maimonides.
Totally. He uses it to clarify this whole concept of purpose, or taklit in Hebrew.
Okay, tell us about this one.
So he uses the example of a young boy learning Torah from a teacher. Now, the act of learning Torah itself, the source points out, is inherently good, right? It's seen as a path to human perfection.
Makes sense.
But the boy, because he's young, his understanding is limited, he just can't grasp that abstract value. He doesn't appreciate the learning for its own sake, not yet.
So the teacher needs another way to motivate him, something he can understand and value at his stage.
Precisely. And the parable walks us through the teacher's evolving strategies as the boy, grows and understands a bit more.
Okay.
First stage, immediate small rewards. The teacher might offer, say, nuts, figs, maybe a piece of sugar after a lesson.
Ah, the candy motivation.
Right. The boy studies, sure, but his real goal isn't the learning, it's the food. Getting that treat is his perceived purpose for hitting the books.
So the study is just the effort to get the sugary reward.
Exactly. Then, as he gets a little older, his capacity improves slightly, so the motivation shifts. Maybe slightly more significant material rewards. The teacher promises nice shoes or maybe some new clothing. Again, he studies, but the goal is still external. The new clothes become his sort of temporary purpose for learning.
Okay, stage two. What's next?
Stage three, monetary rewards. As his understanding matures further, he's motivated by the promise of money. You know, learn this chapter well, I'll give you a dinar or two.
Now we're talking.
The money is the target. Receiving it is more important in his mind than the subject matter itself at this stage.
Got it. Food, clothes, money. Is there a final stage in the parable?
Yes. The final stage for a significantly more developed understanding is honor and status.
Ah, social rewards.
Exactly. Study diligently so you can become a respected rabbi or a judge, someone people look up to, whose name is great in the community, both in life and after death.
So he studies to achieve that social standing.
Right. And that becomes his perceived purpose.
These stages, I mean, they make complete sense for teaching a child, moving them along. But what does Maimonides, through the author's analysis here, point out about these motivations from, a higher, more mature perspective?
And that's where it gets really insightful, yeah. The analysis highlights that all these motivations, the food, the clothes, the money, even the honor, are ultimately described as a disgraceful maguna for someone who actually possesses full, mature understanding.
Disgraceful. Wow. What?
Because they're all external transient rewards. They're not the true essence of the activity itself.
Okay, this brings us to a really crucial concept the source discusses, shilo-lishma.
Yes, shilo-lishma. It translates roughly as not for its own sake. It describes doing commandments or studying Torah, not because of the inherent value or the true purpose of the act itself, but purely as a means to achieve something else.
Like all the rewards in the parable.
Exactly like the rewards in the parable.
And the source connects this to that well-known warning from the sages, doesn't it? Do not make of them, words of Torah, a crown.
A crown with which to aggrandize yourself, nor a spade with which to dig.
Yes. It's a direct caution against using spiritual pursuits as just a tool for external gain, whether that's honor or, you know, wealth.
So if those motivations are disgraceful at the highest level, what is the true ideal purpose then, according to Maimonides here?
Well, according to Maimonides, as presented in the source, the ultimate goal, the taklit, of studying Torah and performing commandments is only the knowledge of God.
Yediato bilvad.
Right, yediato bilvad. And cleaving to him, the hidebek babora yitbarak bilvad, connecting with the Creator.
So it's about the knowing and the connecting. Yes. Just as we value truth for its own sake, the commandments are seen as truth. They're fulfilled for the ultimate purpose of that connection, that cleaving to the Creator.
This sounds like the idea of Oved Miahava, serving out of love.
Precisely. Oved Miahava. Believing in the truth and doing the actions purely for the sake of the truth itself, out of love for the Creator, not for what you get out of it.
And the source brings in some pretty powerful support from the sages for this idea.
It really does. You have Antigonus of Soko, who famously said, "Do not be like servants who serve the master in order to receive a reward."
But like servants who serve the master not in order to receive a reward.
Exactly. And this is presented as the path of the truly perfect individual.
There's also Rabbi Elazar, right? Interpreting that verse about delighting in God's commandments.
Yes, emphasizing he greatly delights in his commandments. The delight is supposed to be in the commandments themselves, not in looking forward to the reward for doing them.
The act itself is the reward, in a sense.
In a very deep sense, yes. And there's that stark warning in the Sifri text the source mentions, explicitly stating one should not study Torah for wealth or for honor or even, interestingly, for reward in the world to come itself.
Wow. Not even for reward in Olam Haba.
Not if that's the primary driver. It ties everything back to the core motivation, to love the Lord, doing everything only out of that pure love. Abraham is even held up as the prime example of this level of service.
Okay, wow. That sounds, well, incredibly high. An incredibly high bar to reach, serving purely out of love, with zero thought of personal gain or avoiding punishment. I mean, is that realistically achievable for everyone, all the time?
And the source acknowledges that challenge head on. Look, serving purely from love, without seeking reward or fearing punishment, it is incredibly difficult. It's definitely not the default human setting, you know?
We're kind of wired differently.
We are. We're generally wired to pursue benefit and avoid harm. That's natural.
So what did the sages do about this gap between the ideal and, well, human nature? Did they just expect everyone to somehow jump straight to that highest level?
No, and this is where their wisdom, which the source highlights, is really key. Because this ideal level is so hard for most people to reach immediately, they actually permitted it. They even encouraged the masses, the term used is haman, to perform good deeds with the hope of reward, and to avoid bad deeds out of fear of punishment.
Okay, so acting for reward or out of fear isn't the ideal, according to Maimonides' framework here, but it's acceptable, maybe even necessary for most people.
Exactly. The source is clear that this approach is not complete or not perfect as it should be, but, and this is crucial, it's significantly better than doing nothing at all.
Right. Better to do good for the wrong reason than not do good at all.
Precisely. And critically, it serves as a kind of gate or preparation. The Hebrew terms are tukuna fakshara. Think of it like training wheels on a bike. It helps you get started, helps you move forward. And the hope is that the process itself, the engagement with the Torah and commandments, even if initially motivated by reward, can lead to a deeper understanding over time.
And eventually, potentially, lead to serving purely out of love.
That's the goal. It brings to mind that key saying mentioned in the source, a person should always engage in Torah, even not for its own sake.
Because from not for its own sake, one comes to for its own sake.
Exactly. It's a pragmatic path towards growth. You start with the motivations you have, even if they aren't perfect, and the engagement itself can refine you, can elevate those motivations.
That makes sense.
The source also points out the caution the sages had, particularly around publicizing Antigonus of Soko's idea about serving without reward.
Why the caution?
They were worried, apparently, that if the masses heard that the absolute highest level required this pure, non-reward-based motivation, they might just feel it was completely impossible for them.
And just give up entirely.
Yeah, throw their hands up and say, well, I can't do that, so why bother?
So they needed to teach people according to their capacity, sort of meet them where they were at.
Exactly. It sounds very much like that principle of answering a fool according to his folly, meaning addressing someone based on their current level of understanding, or the broader idea the source connects it to, speaking in the language of man.
Dibur Torah, Bilshan B. Adam.
Right. You use terms, concepts, metaphors that people can actually grasp, even if those concepts aren't the ultimate, deepest layer of truth, in order to guide them towards that truth.
Like using the promise of sugar to get the boy to learn in the first place.
Precisely. And this concept, speaking in the language of man, is absolutely crucial for understanding Maimonides' view on Olam Haba itself.
Okay, perfect timing. Let's connect it all back.
Yeah.
We started with the puzzle of Olam Haba. We've explored the parable about motivation, the ideal of serving out of love versus the practical necessity of reward and fear. Now, where does Olam Haba fit into Maimonides' framework based on all this?
Great question. So Maimonides, guided by this whole understanding of true purpose, clarifies something fundamental. The ultimate goal of the commandments cannot be merely achieving physical pleasure or monetary gain.
Just like the ultimate purpose of learning isn't getting nuts and sugar?
Exactly. The purpose is that spiritual perfection, the recognition of God, Hakarat Hashem, and cleaving to him, Lehadabek Babora. That's the end point.
Okay. And if that is the ultimate purpose, this internal spiritual connection, not external physical pleasure, then what does that mean for Olam Haba itself?
It means Olam Haba itself cannot primarily be defined by physical resurrection or the nitty-gritty details of some future physical world.
Ah, because that would make the goal physical again.
Exactly. To say Olam Haba Isis resurrection fundamentally misunderstands the purpose, according to Maimonides' view presented here. It frames the ultimate goal as a physical state, which contradicts the profoundly spiritual nature of the true purpose of a life lived according to the commandments.
So when the Torah or the sages do talk about physical rewards, punishments, or even details about resurrection,
the source suggests Maimonides understands this as them speaking in the language of man.
Using understandable, tangible concepts.
Like the sugar for the boy.
To motivate and guide people towards the deeper spiritual truth. Because that ultimate spiritual goal is just really hard to grasp directly.
Right. It's abstract. It's profound. So you use more concrete language as a bridge.
So the physical descriptions then are more like teaching tools, maybe necessary steps along the way, but not the essence of the final destination itself.
That really seems to be Maimonides' point, as presented in the source, yes. The source's conclusion about his view of Olam Haba is basically that it is the state, or the realm, where that perfect knowledge and recognition of God is finally and fully achieved.
The ultimate spiritual connection.
Yes. It's described as the world of souls, Olam HaNeshama. Now, the source does clarify, referencing perhaps other parts of Maimonides' work or related discussions, that physical resurrection does happen for the worthy, and that enables them to live a long, perfect physical life. but Olam Haba itself, the ultimate state that follows that perfected physical existence, that is this profound spiritual attainment. It's not primarily about the physical existence, even the resurrected kind.
That's fascinating. So physical resurrection might be part of the journey, maybe even a prerequisite stage for some, but Olam Haba, the ultimate end, the true goal, is defined by that deep spiritual state of knowing and cleaving to the Creator.
That appears to be Maimonides' really revolutionary point here. He shifts the focus dramatically away from external physical outcomes and squarely onto internal spiritual transformation as the true ultimate purpose and the very essence of Olam Haba.
Okay, let's try and bring this all together then. We started by noting how often the discussion around Olam Haba gets focused on, you know, physical bodies, resurrection details.
Right, the common understanding.
And we've unpacked Maimonides' perspective thanks to this insightful article, which presents a surprisingly different, much more spiritual view.
Yeah, the core insight really is that for Maimonides, the ultimate purpose of a life dedicated to Torah and commandments isn't about getting external rewards or physical pleasure or even status. It's about internal perfection.
That profound recognition of that knowledge of and ultimately that connection with the Creator.
Exactly.
And Olam Haba then is the state or the realm where this spiritual perfection is finally fully realized.
Yeah.
It's a perspective that really challenges us, you listening right now, to look beyond the immediate tangible rewards we might seek in anything we do.
Yeah, whether it's money or status or even just praise.
Right, and to consider what the true fundamental purpose of our actions, our efforts, our growth might actually be. It's a really powerful call to understand the why behind the what we do every day.
And maybe this understanding raises an important question for you to think about. Maimonides suggests that serving out of love purely for the sake of truth and connection itself is the highest ideal we can strive for. So, if acting for reward or acting out of fear are really just necessary stages, like those training wheels, meant to help us begin the journey when we can't yet reach that pure motive, what does it mean to truly try and strive for something for its own sake in your own life?
That's a deep question. What would your actions, your work, your relationships, maybe even your hobbies look like if they were driven purely by a love for the inherent truth of it or the value of the act itself, rather than always looking for that external outcome or reward?
Something to definitely think about as you go about your day.